The New Testament, therefore, was written in Greek. It's borrowed a few words, and it's borrowed more than a few sentence constructions and shapes and thought forms from Aramaic and Hebrew, but it's actually written in Greek. And so when you get the Gospels, for example, it will record the teaching of Jesus in Greek, for example, the Lord's Prayer, which was almost certainly originally taught in Aramaic. And so if you've got nothing better to do on a rainy afternoon, you can spend time trying to reconstruct the Aramaic out of the Greek. But that's always a speculative exercise. John's Gospel, which we're working through in the next year on this basis, I've chosen it quite deliberately because I think it was written very differently from the other Gospels. It's often been thought to be the latest Gospel. I think that's only sort of true. I think it's sort of true because he wrote it more slowly than the others. My own opinion is that John probably started his Gospel before the others and finished it after them. And whereas Mark or somebody would have, as it were, rattled his off in the space of 3 months, I get the impression that John's Gospel was written perhaps over 30 years, or possibly even longer, and even towards the end, that others, not just John himself, but some of his companions would have helped put it together. So it's a process of composition, which wasn't just because he was slow, wasn't really at all because he's slow, it's because the whole thing as you read it is a deep meditation on the Gospel. So if Matthew, Mark and Luke tell the story, yes, so does John, but in the process it's presented much more theologically. It doesn't mean it's less true, accurate historically, necessarily. Sometimes I think it's more accurate than the others in my two places. But it does mean you've always got several layers of meaning. You've got depth to meaning, at least. And in terms of what we're doing today and in the coming months, I think it means we're justified in looking very closely at the words. Sometimes in Mark, if he uses a word, you think he might just as well have used another one. And if you put too much weight on a word, then it starts to sort of topple over. Whereas in John's Gospel, I think just about every word is very, very carefully chosen. And if it wasn't right, you'd go back and change it, like writing a poem over a long period of time. So I think we're well justified in looking in quite some detail at some of the specific words that John uses. And I think you'll get a feel for that as we do it and why I think it's important. And the last thing on here I've put in my first little paragraph is the challenge of translation. And again, I'm sure you're all aware of this, that you'll know various different languages yourself, either to a school boy or girl level, if no further, but probably beyond, I suspect. And you'll know, therefore, that when you translate, it's not one-for-one correlation. That words overlap in meaning, they shade in different directions. That there is often idiom and phraseology which simply doesn't translate literally because it doesn't make any sense. You'll find some of those in John's Gospel. Because there isn't an equivalent idiom in the other language. And constantly in translation, you have to decide how freely shall I translate so as to communicate the meaning, or how literally shall I translate so as to communicate the precise words? And those two are often two slightly different things, even opposing things sometimes, if you follow me. You can do it very literally, but then people reading it will get the wrong impression because the words have shifted. We'll find some examples in John. Chapter 2 is full of them, for example. You'll know that task, I suspect. I meant to say slightly earlier on, do any of you know any Greek, ancient Greek, New Testament Greek, Byzantine Greek? My wife does. Yes. But you know some other languages. Some of you know Latin, to some extent. Good. Okay, very similar shape. You know, subordinate clauses with conjunctions and subjunctives, all that sort of stuff. Do you remember this from your youth? Greek is a very similar shape to Latin. That the cases, and the tenses, sort of pluperfects and all those sort of things. Yep. Okay, so you'll have some idea of the shape. When I talk about the language, I'll try and do it in a way that works for you, but please, I'm going to talk quite a bit. I encourage you to interrupt. If time allows, and at the end, I'd be very pleased if you want to actually raise things I haven't talked about at all, because there may be bits in John 18 and 19 which I'm only touching on 4 or 5 words. So every session, you might as well get used to this. Do look at the chapters in advance. Now you know what they are. They're on your sheet of dates. And if there's anything that sort of strikes a discordant note, bring it along and say, John, why is that there? And we can do that. But I'm going to talk about three words in a few moments, but I'm going to begin with a different one. I'm still under the section marked Introduction on the sheet. I've given you all the verses I'm talking about on the sheet, so you don't need a Bible, but I mean, by all means, turn to it if you want a wider context. And I'm just giving you an example of the task of translation and the importance of translation in translating the scriptures by looking from our chapters at verse 35 of chapter 19. Mike, would you like to read that out to us? I'll lean in your direction so the microphone can hear you.
He who saw it, the eyewitness, gives this evidence, and his testimony is true, and he knows that he tells the truth, that you may believe also.
Right, okay. He's taken it from his Bible from our sheet. But of course it says the same sort of thing. He who saw this has testified that you almost may believe. He's actually talking about the person who saw Jesus stabbed with a spear on the cross. And I've put in bold there the word believe. I'll write it up here. In case you're interested, the Greek for believe is a thing called pistuo. In English, that's, I can never think of it in English letters, pistuo. And the noun from it is pistis. Some of you are old enough to have been baptised or had your children baptised with the old 1662 service. And the godparents will be asked by the priest in the service, do you believe in God? And they would answer, I believe in him. They don't ask that anymore since 1980, revised again in 2000. Do you know what they ask instead? I say to people, do you believe
and trust
in God? And the reason that I say, do you believe and trust in God, is because pistuo, which is based upon, credo in Latin, does not mean believe, primarily, or only at least, in the current sense of the word believe. It's a heart word at least as much, and a will word at least as much as a head word. So, you see, believing in God is all very well. The devil believes in God and doesn't do him much good. If believe means to have intellectual opinions, that's what we normally think about belief. You know, do you believe in fairies? It means, do you believe they exist? Do you believe in God? Do you believe he exists? That's how we tend to use the word nowadays. It means to have an opinion about the factuality or the correctness of something. And that's only a subsidiary meaning of the word believe in the Bible. Pistuo, much more than believing, means trusting. The verb is pistuo, I believe. The noun, pistis, is sometimes translated belief, but usually in the New Testament it's translated faith. There are no two words in the Bible for belief and faith. There is only one word, pistis. There are no two words for to believe a fact and to believe in a person. It's pistuo. So do you see how already we've got overlapping of meanings? Meaning you could, which way do I shade it? Which verb do I choose when I translate it into English? John in particular, more than the other gospel writers, often helps us. Because with pistuo, he has several different ways of using it. He can use it with the accusative, that's to say with a direct object. He can use it with a dative. That's an indirect object. He can use it with a preposition, epi or en, and sometimes, which means to or in, and sometimes he uses it with the preposition eis, which means into. And as you read John, you get used to how he does it. And he's got like a gradation from believing something in a fairly intellectual sense. I said, it's cold outside, and you didn't believe me, that's a sort of, you know, do you accept the correctness of a statement? Right through to committing your life to something or someone, which is what he uses pistuo eis, to believe or trust into. American preachers, old-fashioned American preachers, I can't do the accent, would say, do you believe on the Lord Jesus Christ. Have you ever heard that phrase? Yeah, good old-fashioned sort of Billy Graham preachers. Do you believe on? What they're doing is that's the American for pistuo ace. We don't do that in English, but the Americans do it. Not many things the Americans do better than us linguistically, but there's one of them. They've got their own way of translating pistuo ace. So this is just an example. I'm using this purely as an example of the task of translation. So when the translators came to that this thing here, Liz, have you got it open in front of you? You probably have you?
Yeah.
Okay, verse 35. After pistuo, what's the object? How does it work? Hina pistuete.
Hina kai humes pistuete.
No object. Okay, we're quite right, there isn't an English, is there? All right, so in fact, you're given no clue there from how the object is handled by John, of which, what depth is he giving to pistuo. But, you see, believe, I'm not sure I would have translated it like that. I think I would have translated it to have faith. But it could be believe, because if when this happened, the spear was thrust into Jesus and blood and water came out, and this was seen at the time for some reason to be a very significant event, that perhaps would have been an event which triggered an agreement. Yes, perhaps he really was the Son of God. So you could just say it's to do with believing. Or you could say that the whole experience of witnessing the death of Jesus led someone to trust more deeply in the loving purposes of God in Christ. So it's to have faith. So there's one thing I'm saying to you about pistuo. I've got to say a second thing to you about it. This is purely an example of the task of translation. What have I put down here? I put use of tenses. Yes, I get under the range of meaning, the use of tenses in English and Greek. Now, you know what tenses are? Past, future, present, yeah, that sort of thing. Okay. Let's have a quick revision. I don't want to insult you, but nevertheless, I go, it's a present tense. Okay. I am going, also a present tense. So you see, you begin to see that even the words tenses are not terribly helpful, because you get more tenses than you have names for them. So this is a present continuous, for example, that would be. That's how Indians and Pakistanis speak, isn't it? They use the present continuous constantly because it matches something in their own native languages. Okay. I went. What tense is that? Past tense. Okay. I have gone. What tense is that? Past. Okay. Well, yes, exactly. They're both past tenses. So can we give them other names? What's the name for the I have gone tense? Perfect. It's a perfect tense. This is the way we usually use words. There's no right answers. I'm just discovering how you use words here. If you've learnt Latin, you'll have called that one the perfect. What do you call that one? I went. If you're doing French, that'll be passé composé, because it's I have gone, it's composed. That'll be passé simple, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. Or préterite. Yes? What do we call it in English, though? Nobody ever knows. Nobody ever knows. There we are. You can go home and think about it. In Greek, we call it the aorist. If anyone's heard of an aorist, you probably haven't, you see. In Greek, you've got the two tenses, I have gone and I went. And in Greek, they're perfect and aorist. In Latin, you don't have both. Amavi is both I have loved and I loved. They haven't got two tenses in Latin. The Americans don't have two tenses. They never use the passé composé. They always use the passé simple. The French, by contrast, don't use the passé simple, except in writing. They always say something has happened. So very few languages use both forms of the past. Greek does, and British English does. Which is rather nice, because it means that we can translate the subtleties of the New Testament in a way that French and the Americans can't, because we have two past tenses, as Greek does. But what I'm saying to you is that's not terribly important. What I'm saying to you is something slightly more important, that we use tenses almost entirely to designate time, when it happened. So there are subtle distinctions between present and present continuous, between passé simple and passé composé, because we use them to tell the subtleties of time. And many other languages are not the least interested in time. Hebrew it's only got two tenses, finished and unfinished. And in the unfinished tense, you don't know if it's present, future, or perfect. And the other tense is everything else. Because they're not totally interested in how it happened. Whereas we have only two voices, active and passive. Greek has three, Hebrew's got 5 and Arabic's got 9. So you see, languages work very differently.
Hang on, I think you mean they're not very interested in when it happened.
Sorry, did I say
they
that?
They are interested in how it
is. So, I beg your pardon.
That's how they have all their different...
I'm so sorry.
Just because it's been recorded.
Yeah, quite right. Correct me for the sake of everybody else as well as future generations. Yes, they're interested in... They're not very interested in when it happened. They're much more interested in how it happened. To what degree it happened. And things like that. And with what degree of intentionality it happened. Was it accidental or deliberate? And so they've got many different verb forms to communicate that. I'm telling you this because Greek is not half so interested in time as English is. So when you find a Greek tense, it is very likely not primarily telling you when something happened, but telling you something different. And in this verse, he who saw this, that you also may believe. What's very interesting is the tense they use. In English, it'll be a future subjunctive, in effect. That's a disguised future subjunctive, if you know your English grammar, because it's going to happen in the future, because we only use it for time. Now, Greek doesn't use it for time, primarily. In Greek, it's either going to be a present or a future or an aorist for other purposes. And, most unusually, it's a present. Greek very rarely uses a present subjunctive. You'd expect it to be more likely to be an aorist. Because in Greek, they're very interested for some reason in whether something happened as a one-off action or continuously or repeatedly over a period of time. And this is very interesting theologically, which is what I'm telling you. Because you see, a huge element of the Reformation was the nature of the death of Christ. Was it a completed action, complete and sufficient for all time? Or was it part of a process of God's saving work in the world in which we have a part to play with our additional actions, whether it be good works or the offering of the Mass? I don't want to caricature, but there's a sense in which that verbal debate was part of the thing about the Reformation. And a sort of great Protestant ideal is to do with the completed work of Christ. And in some branches of the Protestant tradition, it isn't just the work of Christ that's completed, but they particularly look for things like conversion as a specific act. Have you been saved? Can you put a date on it, for example? Again, I'm not meaning to caricature, I'm just trying to sort of summarise and simplify for the sake of explaining tenses. And you might well expect that John writing this would say, so that you also may come to faith. Here is Jesus dying. He's writing to a wide audience. He wants them to believe in Christ. But you see, in this tense, in this sentence, it's using the present subjunctive. And as soon as you know that, you realize he's not doing it to bring people to faith. That would be an aorist subjunctive. He's doing it to bolster and increase the faith of believers. Because it's a continuing process in which they're already engaged. That's why it's a present subjunctive. And so he's writing to them saying, here you are, Christian believers, listen to this wonderful thing that happened on the cross. Doesn't that encourage you and deepen your faith? All that is hidden in the tense of that verb, believe. Now, this actually isn't terribly important. Things don't stand or fall on this. You can say, so what? And you're welcome to say, so what? Because I'm only using it as an example of how once you start to get into the subtleties of how tenses are used, how vocabulary overlaps in meaning, because it means believe and trust, you immediately got a whole range of tasks in translating to think, how much do I try and communicate this to my readers and make all my sentences 3 times as long by padding them out, and how much do I just simply write it like this so that you also may believe? And time and again, quite rightly, the translators of the Bible go for brevity, simplicity, clarity, succinctness. And that's good, because then you can read it and hear it and don't start yawning too quickly. But in the process, do you see how much is buried beneath the surface? So there's a sentence which, you know, if you know Greek, John is saying, I'm telling you this to increase the faith you already have. Okay, an extended introduction. Let's have a little stop for a moment. We're going to look at 3 more important things in the Gospel, in these chapters, in just a moment, under my next 3 headings. I'm going to look at 3 words, paradidomi, ego eimi, and telio, for our main diet today. So shall we do the next section? Handing over for better or worse. And I've said a single word, paradidomi, does a great deal of work. Sarah, would you just read that verse for us?
Then he handed him over to them to be crucified.
Okay, oops. Paradidomi. What you've got there, just so you know, is a typical Greek word. It's a bit like German. It loves to string things together to make long words. You've got the beginning bit, para, you've got the end bit, didomi. Didomi means I give, and para, it's very hard to say what it means, but it's to hand over, to pass on. It's that sort of preposition on the front of it, okay? And I think it does look a great deal of work. And you get a what I would call a normal, a non-coloured version of paradidomi in verse 16 of chapter 19 that Sarah just read to us, that Pilate handed Jesus over. It literally means he took Jesus by the scruff of the neck, so to speak, and passed him on to somebody else. And that is, as it were, a neutral use of the word paradidomi, to pass someone or something on. So I've said this in the next paragraph. It's a neutral word, often used with positive connotations. So the tradition of the communion service was handed down to Paul by the church leaders. He says in 1 Corinthians 11, doesn't he, I have passed on to you what I myself received. Okay, that's paradidomi and paralambano. Paul was commended to God's grace when commissioned. They paradidomied Paul to God when they sent him out to go and preach the gospel. The householder in the parable of talents paradidomies his money to his servants before he goes. So it's a normal word for handing over, and often quite a beneficial handing over.
There's not a sense of reluctance in this handing over, because in my Bible it says, finally, I handed
over. Yeah. Well, I think he was reluctant.
Well, he was, that's what I'm
Yes, he was reluctant. He was reluctant. But you wouldn't know that from the word paradidomi, but it's a neutral word in that context. But certainly, yes, it's not a joyful handing over there, is it? It's quite the reverse, really. But it's got a very specific use. Beulah, can you see the next bit? Now Judas, can you see that?
Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, because Jesus often met there with his disciples.
Okay, Judas knows about Gethsemane, and he betrayed Jesus. And the words in bold are all the same word, paradidomi. And what's very interesting here is that for some reason, although there is a Greek word for betray, which is prodidomi, and although paradidomi doesn't really mean betray, it's not used to mean betray almost anywhere else except in the Gospels, it has become the traditional word used for the betrayal of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Which I think is fascinating. Now, I don't know if you know any of Bill Vanstone's writings. He's only written, well, he only wrote, I should say. There we are, you see, it's past tense because he's now dead. If he were alive, I'd use a passive composer. He has written. He's died. I used a passive sample. He wrote. He only wrote three books, all of which are fantastic. And the second one he wrote is a thing called The Stature of Waiting. And if you're at a stage of life when you can no longer do as much as you used to, and you feel less effective as a Christian as a result, through old age or infirmity in particular, then this is compulsory reading. Because it talks about how the purposes of God are not worked through activism, but by actually being passive. And it was in Jesus' passivity that the work of God was most truly done. Fantastic book. But, I mean, he waxed eloquent about paradidomi, it so happens, because it's all to do with this. Because Jesus was allowing himself to be handed over. But it's become somehow a sort of jargon word for the betrayal by Judas. And I think this is important theologically, because it wasn't just a spiteful act, but in the wider context, it was part of the intention of Jesus and the loving purposes of God for the salvation of the world. And so it's always described in a strikingly neutral stroke positive word. And yet, every translation always gives it the negative slant, understandably, of betray. And yet not once did the Gospels say that Judas betrayed Jesus. Not once. They never used the word prodidomi. Every time they use a word which is basically more positive. And my question there is why? They've done it for a reason. I'm not looking for a correct answer. Your guess is as good as mine. But do you see the openness? It's not open and shut. Lots of things in the Bible aren't open and shut. We're invited in to respond to a process which is very ambivalent.
It's a horrid word, betrayal, isn't it?
Yes.
It's a really horrid word.
And it's surprising when you see how the early Christians, I mean, I think I can say it, hated Judas, they didn't use it.
I think that they must almost have accepted, however, that, you know, particularly it being referred to and foretold of in the Old Testament, that there is that sense of it not actually being Judas's fault. Almost fatalistic, you know, it was fated to be that way, and therefore
that he was God's instrument.
It is being, you know, it's being worked through him in the same way as, you know, lots of things are worked through people for good. Actually, this, it was worked through Judas for good because Christ went to the cross.
Ultimately.
Therefore, having a negative
word wouldn't do it justice. No, exactly.
I mean, do you know what Wycliffe used?
It'd be fascinating to know, wouldn't it? The short answer is no.
No, okay.
No. You see, a lot of them, Wycliffe, of course, went back to the Greek, as did all these writers, but a lot of it was shaped by their awareness of the Latin scriptures, because all the early translators of the Bible into English would have known the Latin Bible better. They'd have known it the way we know the English Bible. In Latin, it's trado. And trado in Latin, it means both paradidomi and protodomi. They don't have two words for that. And so you see, you're sort of filtering through a language that hasn't got the same subtlety, and it comes out the other side into English, really, with the negative connotations. Trado, in English, you've got very negative words from trado in Latin semantically, like traitor, that comes from, that's a Latin traditor. A traitor from trado. You've got very positive words. Tradition. That comes from trado. So you see, Latin's got this sort of one word, and it comes out the other side of the sausage machine into English, translating these passages. And it's gone the negative route. Whereas in fact, you see, the Greeks are using, having got the two words, positive and negative, they're using the neutral or even positive word for it at every point. I think we're right. This isn't a sort of puzzle or a test. I'm sure we're right. It must be because they were so aware of the beneficial context, like calling this coming Friday Good Friday, not Bad Friday. It must be because they're so aware of that they instinctively use this providential word for the act of Judas. But I think there's so much to it, to that feeling. It helps me because I let God down appallingly and do some terrible things. And yet in the great purposes of God, it's all put in the mix, you know, and I become a better person, I hope, through it, and God works his work despite me and stuff. I think it's a very positive angle on the whole process.
But it's a shame that it hasn't had, didn't in the past have that positive effect in terms of Judas, because calling him the betrayer led to a lot of hatred of the Jews.
Yes, that's true.
And anti-Semitism.
That's true. Rather than them seeing
that it was all in God's plan.
Yeah, the Jews are a channel of God's purposes.
Yeah.
Agents of his purposes, yes.
Yeah, so it wasn't completely successful, was it?
Well, no, it's not successful.
There are two ends to Judas, aren't there? There's one, yeah. He goes and weeps bitterly and hangs himself.
Yes.
And the other, he fell down in the...
He fell off a cliff and his guts burst open. Yes, that's right. Yes, there's two alternative fates for Judas, neither of them particularly edifying. No, indeed, but it's interesting, though. But then you see, it's also very unusual. Only that what I've just described is done by all the gospel writers. They all use paradidomi. But the next one is unique to John. Sue, would you read the next verse, please?
Then he bowed his head and gave up his spirit.
Yes. Now, this is the most extraordinary use of paradidomi, really. Jesus paradidomied his spirit. That's how John, only John, describes the death of Jesus. And what it is a deliberate handing over. And what I say here is, do you see how the initiative has changed? I think what John is doing, he's painting Jesus as being, allowing himself to be the passive, I was going to say agent, that's the opposite of passive really, the passive player in the drama of the arrest and trial and crucifixion. And yet, behind the scenes, we'll see this in the next section actually, it is under his control. This is a voluntary act, self-giving. So I've said, was Jesus' life taken or did he give it? And you see, in John's Gospel, the very fact that John uses such an assertive, an active word for his death, that he passed on his spirit. I don't know if you're invited to imagine who to. He yielded it to God, possibly. I mean, spirit means to his life, really. He yielded it to God, possibly. There's some commentators say that John is intending here that he's passing on his own spirit to his followers, that what Jesus started would carry on forever, which is an equally possible meaning of the phrase. In fact, grammatically, it's the more likely meaning of the phrase, as in the passing on of tradition that we saw above, the story of the communion and things. The commissioning for service of Paul. We looked at that a moment ago. So in that sense, the word is suggestive of all those things. This is where I'm talking to you about the nuance of words. I can't tell you it means this or it means that. Words don't work that way. I'm talking about the feelings that words stir up inside you, the associations they carry with them, the suggestions they make to us. And all those, for the death of Jesus in John, is a voluntary self-giving for our benefit. And in a sense, Jesus himself completes the work that Judas started. The same verb is used of Judas and Jesus. Do you see? It's terribly rich, isn't it, that sort of feeling? And I mean, if you don't know Greek, which most of you admitted you don't, then certainly to have three different translations in front of you, if you want to do some serious Bible study once in a while, it's fascinating to see the interplay between them. Yeah. Okay. That's our first one. Any reactions to paradidomi? That's the first of our three words.
It's confusing because the two words are so similar to an outsider.
Which are paradidomi and protodomi. Yes. But if you think in English, the difference between, for example, receive and deceive, you could say it's only one letter difference, but to English speakers, they're totally different words. And to Greek speakers, protodomi and paradidomi would be very different. Okay, next section, the one who is. When God sent Moses to rescue the Hebrew people from Egypt, Moses asked God's name. Do you remember the story? It's the burning bush. And do you remember what the answer was? Tell me something. What was the answer? God said, I am who? Very good. Different translations translate in different ways, of course. We're talking Hebrew now, aren't we? I am. Yes. I think very often I am who I am is perhaps one of the more grammatical ways of translating it. It isn't grammatical. What God said isn't a grammatical sentence, so it's very hard to translate it. Most Bible versions, I think, would say, I am who I am, with a footnote saying, or, I will be who I will be. Or, I am who I will be. Do you remember I said there are only two tenses in Hebrew? So it could be any of those. It could even be, I am who I used to be. So, I mean, do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Now, what's going on there? Let's have a think. In all this, by the way, you get used to me, don't you? You get the Partington opinion about things passed off as though it's fact all the time. You have to get used to that. So I'm telling you Partington opinion as though it's fact at the moment. It seems to me that what's going on is that the Egyptians had loads of gods. And if you go and say to an Egyptian, God says do this, they're going to say to you, which god? Was it Osiris or who was it, you see? And so Moses is doing the same trick because Moses was brought up in Egypt. And he says, well, which god are you? And God is in effect saying, I'm the only god. I am the one. I am who I am. The one who is. And the reason we have names is to distinguish each other, ourselves from each other. So if I say someone's name in this room, somebody knows who I'm talking to. That's the only reason we have names, is to distinguish. If there's only one of us, we wouldn't need a name. And there's only one of God, so God doesn't need a name, and God hasn't got a name. And so God says, I am the one who is. That's all you need to know, the one who is. You can take it further than that philosophically, that God is the only one who truly is. And when you get in Greek, by the way, for example, different words for to be in an existential sense and to be in a contingent sense, happening to be. You see, we don't exist in that essential sense as human beings. We're only passing through. We won't be here in a few years' time. So Greek uses a different word for our being from what it does for God, because God exists anyway. God will still be here in 20 years, even if the rest of us are dead, well, apart from Sarah, who's quite young. But that's the reality. It uses different words. So God is saying, I'm the one who exists. I'm the only one who truly exists. Do you want a little bit of an excursus on this, just for 3 minutes? It's rather fun.
I'm
going to
give it anyway.
I am. God. Well, at least those won't be the next two sessions, and I can get away with this. I think I'll say two things to you. God said, I am. It's often, you'll find, I am Yahweh. Do you remember Yahweh from your Bible translations? Okay. That's it in Hebrew. It reads from right to left, by the way. Y-H-W-H. Yahweh. They wrote Hebrew without any vowels, but like, is it Pittman's shorthand? Or does that have vowels? Greg's shorthand? No one uses shorthand now.
But speed writing.
Speed writing probably doesn't, yes. But Hebrew didn't use vowels. So Y-H-W-H, which is the present or future tense of the verb to be. That's who God is. I think I'll say two things to you about it. It's purely for curiosity, because as Liz knows, I can't resist telling people things. The first one is that although the Jews didn't have vowels, that they wanted to distinguish a short vowel from a long vowel, o from o, and a from r, and things. And they needed a technique for doing that. And they did that by using consonants. The consonants they used were Y, H, and W. Because every long vowel has got a consonant on the end, if you listen. O has a W on the end. I has a Y on the end. R has an H on the end. So the consonants H, Y, and W were used by the Hebrews, by the Jewish people, to signify long vowels. So another way of looking at the name of God is the whole series of long vowels with no consonants. But the thing about a word with vowels and no consonants, you can't say it. You can't say it. There's no shape to it. And so some of the Jewish mystics used to say that the name of God, which is so holy it must not be said, it wasn't just that it mustn't be said, it couldn't be said. It is ineffable, quite literally as well as morally. But not only shouldn't they couldn't they. But that's just a little bit of Jewish mysticism, which I think is rather jolly. But more important is because the Jews found the name of God so holy that they never said it, that whenever they saw the word Yahweh, they used to say Adonai, which is the Hebrew for Lord. And I personally find it rather, I'm embarrassed that so many Christian Bibles have Yahweh in them, because I feel that must be irritating to Jews who aren't allowed to say Yahweh. And so the Jews, when I learned Hebrew, I was taught, whenever I saw those letters, not to say them, I was taught to say Adonai instead. Adonai is the Hebrew for Lord, my Lord to be precise. And so when they came later to put vowels in the Old Testament, which they did, so if you look at an Old Testament now, it's got vowels in it, they put in those vowels there, which are the vowels of Adonai, to remind them when they saw that to say that. Do you follow this? Have I lost you yet? Do you know can you guess what comes next? You put these together in an unthinking way, and you get the word Jehovah.
I've noticed that there was a basis for Jehovah.
Yes, that's the basis for Jehovah. It's the vowels of Yahweh with the consonants No, that's not right. The consonants of Yahweh and the vowels of Adonai make this non-existent word Jehovah. So you see, when the Jehovah's Witnesses tell you that the true name of God is Jehovah, they really have no clue what they're talking about. Because it's purely a word that nobody's ever spoken, except for people who are so ignorant, that when they see this and that, think you're supposed to put them together. They don't know that. That is a clue to say something different, because of the ineffability of the name of God.
Why was it so popular with the Puritans then?
I don't know. I don't know.
It was funny, because they were keen on it, weren't they?
They were. They were.
How did they know that it wasn't written till the end?
How do we know? In all sorts of ways. Because you get collections of the old books, the scriptures that haven't got it in, that you can see references in it that come from much later. Obviously, it's got frantically early material in it. No one's saying that. It's, you know, it's got the earliest material in the Old Testament's in there, isn't it? These very early stories about the patriarchs and things. But there's been a process of compilation in which it's pulled together from different sources, some of which are still very visible. You can get further in and see the different hands in it. Traditionally, it's now not quite done this way. They talk about J, E, D and P as the four main strands in Genesis, of which D is the latest strand. That's the same school of theology that produced the book of Deuteronomy. That's why it's called D. And these are pulled together in Genesis. But, I mean, it doesn't mean it wasn't around. It just means in the written form we have it. You know, it's like a sort of last one to be edited. But it doesn't mean the material is late. The material is very early in there. And they had it in the Torah from early days, didn't they? But in the form which we now have it, it is a late book. What am I talking about? Oh, yes. Okay. So when you've got the word Yahweh, and they come to put that in Greek, they translate it, when they do, as ego eimi. I've written that out for you in English. Ego, I can't do English and Greek at the same time. Ego eimi. So they do that. Now, you said you know Latin, some of you. Who reckons they know Latin? Let's pounce on you. Daphne, you learned Latin at school. No, Vula, you know Latin. You know, you must have Latin.
Not much.
You lose it every day, I expect, don't you?
Medieval Latin.
Medieval Latin. Okay.
Ego is I.
Well, there we are. Well, I was going to ask you, what's the Latin for I love?
Amo.
Amo. Exactly. See, we all know Latin. We all know Latin. Yeah. The Latin for I love is not ego, amo. The ego is the Latin for I. The Latin for I love is ego. Is amo. Yeah? Because they don't use pronouns with verbs. Because they don't need to. Because the verb endings tell you which person it is. If it's I or you or he.
Italian as well.
In Italian, yeah. Same principle then. Because if you've got verb endings telling you whether it's he, she, or it, or you, or he, or we, you don't need the pronouns as well. So you only use them for emphasis. It really is me who's doing this. Ego amo, I love that woman. Not you. She's my wife, or whatever. Well,
ipsy.
Yes, ego ipsy, all right. But, okay, and in Greek it's the same. Greek is the same, like Latin, like Italian. It doesn't use pronouns with verbs because it doesn't need to. And so the Greek for I am is eimi, not ego eimi. But when Jesus said, I am the good shepherd, for example, he said, ego eimi, the good shepherd. What is going on? It's obvious what is going on. That he is dabbling with the unutterable divine name. That's what's going on. Because ego eimi is the Greek for Yahweh. Back to our passage. Daphne, can you find it? Are you with us? The bit of scripture under the one who is, then Jesus.
Then Jesus came forward and asked them, for whom are you looking? They answered, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus replied, I am he. When Jesus said to them, "I am he," they stepped back and fell to the ground.
My question is, why do they fall to the ground? There you have, in the darkness in the garden, yes, a highly charged scene with this powerful figure of Jesus, powerful in one sense, morally powerful figure of Jesus, that they're nervous of arresting, but perhaps he's a prophet, but they've been told to go and arrest him, so they have to. Perhaps some of the temple guards believed that he might be the Messiah, but they've been sent to arrest him all the same. And when they come upon him in the darkness, and he says to them, "Ego eimi," then they fall to the ground. And then Jesus takes the initiative and says, "Come on, who are you looking for?" And this is after this passage, the next verse. And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And he said, "Well, here I am, come and get me." So he takes the initiative, because they shrink back in awe when he says to them, "I am he." He says to them, "Ego eimi." Now, isn't that fascinating?
Mm. So dramatic.
So dramatic. But you see, the whole thing is so ambivalent, because although I've said to you the Greeks don't say ego eimi, they just say eimi, that's not quite true. There are various reasons for using a pronoun with a verb, and one of them I've told you is for emphasis. Mm. The other is, if you can work this out in your head, when the predicate of the verb is the same as the subject. I am he, I and he are the same person. Yes? Mm-hmm. That's the predicate is the same as the subject. Mm-hmm. And that is a case in Greek where you do use ego eimi. So a normal person would have said ego eimi, unusually. It wasn't so much the divine name you couldn't say it. It's not like saying Yahweh in Hebrew. But it's very rarely said, and it was used by Greek speakers to explain Yahweh. But it didn't mean you couldn't use it in conversation when the context made clear what you were doing. And the context in the garden, yes, ignore the dog, the context in the garden makes clear what's happening, because he says, "I am he." And this is the normal Greek way of saying, "I am he." But in the Garden of Gethsemane, instead of it leading to them arresting him, it leads to them worshipping him, or whatever. So you see the marvellous ambivalence in the darkness here. These people who half believe in Jesus and half don't, who are both afraid of him and coming to kill him. It's wonderful. I put here Johannine, double meaning, haven't I? Yes. So you see, the translators are correct simply to say, "I am he," and on goes the story. But just saying that, you miss all that hinterland of meaning, all of it. We're going to find ego eimi again in the coming months. We'll find it in the "I am the good shepherd, I'm the light of the world." We'll also find it in one other place even more significantly, but I won't spoil your fun by telling it to you now. You've got to keep coming back to find the other use of it. Okay, let's do the last one. Finishing and completing. I like the story of the chap leaning on the gatepost outside a Scottish church. And someone came along and said, "Oh, has the preacher finished?" And the guy said, "Yes, but he hasn't stopped." So there's different ways of using words like finish and stop and so forth. And this is all based around this phrase at the end, "it is finished." So was the death of Jesus a failure or a triumph? The word teleo tells us how John viewed it. And who have we got to next? Jane. Sorry, it's Jane, isn't it? Would you read the next bit of Bible?
"After this, when Jesus knew that all was now finished, he said, 'I am thirsty.' So they put a sponge full of wine on a branch of hyssop and held it to his mouth. When Jesus had received the wine, he said, 'It is finished.' Then he bowed his head and gave up the spirit."
Yeah, we've done the giving up his spirit already, haven't we? Some of you, because it's so well known, some of you may well have heard the Greek expression tetelestai. In English, that's going to be tetelestai, which is a perfect tense of teleo, I finish. And a perfect tense, of course, is a past action with present consequences, as you know from your grammar. it is finished. Now, without knowing Greek, you could think that was just a cry of despair. It's all up with me, or my life has ended, or the story ends here. But if you know what teleo means, it's like the preacher finishing or stopping. If you know what teleo means, then you don't think that, because you realise that teleo really means I accomplish. I don't know how many peculiar words you know in English, but if you know the word teleological, do you? The word teleological is the study of something by analysing its purpose or intention. So teleological, teleo, is to do with purpose. And it actually literally means to fulfil a purpose, to accomplish, to complete. And so after this, when Jesus knew that all was now completed, he'd done all that he needed to on earth. He said, I'm thirsty, and so forth. And then when he dies, the last words on his lips in John's Gospel are, I have completed the task. There is just perhaps a hint in John's Gospel that this rounds off, it bookends the Gospel, because it's, the Gospel starts, as we shall see in about 9 months' time, in the beginning was the word, arche, which means more than merely beginning. So telos means more than merely end. And it's the bookend from the other end of the Gospel, from the beginning of the Gospel, the arche. So you've got a sort of roundedness, a completeness in John's Gospel. He starts off by telling you about the purposes of God from eternity in the incarnation, and the purposes of God in eternity or into eternity with the death of Christ. So there may be a sort of recognition of the shape of things that John uses the word, but much more than that, it's to do with the fact the word means to achieve or to accomplish. And they dug up a piece of pottery about 50 years ago. I think it was pottery, it might have been a papyrus. I think it was papyrus, actually. It was like paper. It was a shopping bill or something like that. It was an invoice which had been receipted. You know, if you get an invoice and you pay it, they stamp it. Oomph, paid or received. They'll say one thing or the other. And this one had been stamped, tetelestai, which was terrific, really. This is a hint of how, in secular speech, it's a paid bill. So it's a very simple bit of theology, but it's an important bit. The death of Jesus, of course, for Christians, wasn't a failure, it was a triumph. And John paints that picture by using the word accomplished. It is finished means I have accomplished it.
It would be a much better word to use, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And all these things, you could say, okay, John, you sound terribly impressive, why didn't they do it then? And it's because in all these things I'm slightly exaggerating. Because in all these things I'm trying to pull out for you the nuance of the word. And yet the literal meaning is to finish. If you want to say I finish in Greek, you probably use teleo. So you see, in each of these points, I'm sort of pulling out the nuance for you. So it would be quite easy to argue that they would be wrong, that they should leave it simple and let people's own, God speaking through the scriptures, people provide nuance today. The difficulty is, as I say, because languages aren't exact, that you get different nuance, and it is finished can sound like failure when teleo can't.
I think the Latin's quite nuanced, the consonantum S.
That's brilliant.
It's right, isn't it?
It's brilliant. Yeah. Mm. Yes.
Because you've got the two meanings.
Yes, you have. One of our Greek, we have a Greek class every fortnight here, and one of them brings parallel Greek and Latin along, which is enormous fun. Because the Latin translation, of course, was done by theologians. Just occasionally good Protestants like me get a bit twitchy because I disagree with their theology. But on the whole, they haven't just sort of slapped it into Latin. They've tried to find deep and rich words. And 19 times out of 20, I agree with that deep and rich word. Very much so on that one. English is wonderful language because it's, as you know, it's a mixture of Saxon-based and Romance-based. So almost everything in English has got two words for it. And over the time, those two words give you two different shades of meaning, slightly different. So we've got great subtlety in almost everything. You know, when you finish something, that's Saxon, or complete it, that's Romance. These sort of things, we've got great subtleties. I like that my finish and stop story. It's a wonderful language, English, because of all the near synonyms which we use for nuance. Yeah. Okay, well, we ended with a simple one there, didn't we? But it's a very important one, that on Good Friday, that it's a completed work. In fact, all three was why I chose these chapters for this week. Was Jesus just betrayed? No. He took the initiative, and even Judas was just working the purposes of God. Was it a failure? No, it was a triumph. It's great stuff, isn't it?